Get up, he said. Holmes sat slowly. Now get your boots. He motioned sideways with his head to where they lay in the floor. He bent to reach for the boots and got one up, fumbling at it with his naked foot. Hold it, the man said, waving the barrels in an arc before his face. He stopped, holding the boot up, watching the man. Just tote 'em with you. He got the other boot and sat there in the bed, holding them in his lap. Now, let's go, the man said, stepping back and motioning toward the door with the shotgun. He rose and crossed the floor and stepped out. The long, flat grass about the house was blanched with frost, the barren landscape beyond sprayed with those small and anonymous birds of winter. He had not thought of such cold weather and was surprised to see it come. Let's go, the man said. He descended the rimed planks and stood barefooted in the yard. The man came down the steps, waving the barrels at him. They crossed through the frozen grass to the fence and then across the iron clods and furrows of the plowed land and into the road. Gee, the man said. Holmes looked at him. The man waved the barrels to the right and he tucked the boots up under his arm and turned down the road, advancing upon his lean and dancing shadow with feet that winced in the cold sand. He could hear behind him the measured tread of the armed man and after a while his breathing, but the man spoke no word. The sun was gaining, and he could feel it a little on his back, and it felt good. When they had gone a mile or better along the road, they came to a wagon road that went off to the right. Here you go, the man said behind him. He turned up the road. It was washed out and weed-grown, and with the mounting sun, water had begun again over the bare stones in the gullies. They climbed on, past high oblique faults of red sandstone, coming at last into a field where the road leveled. Just hop on down, friend, the man said. 'Tain't far now. They came past a barn, and beyond that a frame house mounted at the corners on high cairns of rock. A row of chickens regarded them from the porch. Oh, squire, the man called out, hallooing along his raised palm. Hold up right here, he said to Holmes. He advanced to the porch and rapped on the floor. Oh, there, he called. Come up, said a woman's voice from the house. Go on, the man said. Holmes shifted the boots to the other arm and mounted onto the porch past the chickens and went in. He could smell breakfast cooking. On back, the man said. He crossed the room and went through the door at the far side. The woman was coming in carrying an empty pail. She said howdy without looking at them and went into the kitchen. They followed her. There was a man sitting at the table eating eggs and biscuits from a large platter before him, and as they entered, he looked up at them. He was dressed in his undershirt, a verminous-looking bag of ash-gray flannel, from which the sleeves were gone at the elbow as if chewed off. He turned back to his plate before speaking.
Morning, John. Been hunting.
Hunting housebreakers, the man said.
Have, huh?
Yep. He poked Holmes forward with a shotgun.
This him?
He said, not looking up, spooning eggs sideways onto his fork and into his mouth, his chin almost resting on the table. I caught him in Daddy's old house, a-laying in the bed.
How'd he get in?
How'd you get in? The man said.
I come through the door, Holmes said.
He come through the door.
Dead, huh?
He was a-laying in the bed. The seated squire nodded, wiping up grease from the platter with a large biscuit.
I don't drink coffee, or I'd offer you some,
he said, leaning back and wiping his mouth with the palm of his hand.
Now, what was your name, young feller?
Cullahome.
You a Indian?
No, sir.
What was your first name?
Just Holmes is my last name.
Cullah. Holmes.
Well, the squire said,
say you broke in John's daddy's old house?
I never broke in. I just come in. It wasn't locked nor nothing. I didn't know nobody lived there. There wasn't nothing there to let on like it.
They's furniture, the man with the shotgun said. You was a-laying up in the bed your own self.
They was a dead cat in the other'n, Holmes said.
I never seen it,
he said. He turned to the squire. He throwed the bedding out in the yard for it to rain on. I wasn't going to tell that.
If that would have done it here back in August, I'd have hired him to tote everything I got outside,
the squire said.
It had an old dead cat laying in it,
Holmes said.
All right, hush now,
the squire said.
Home, That's it, ain't it?
Yes, sir.
Where do you come from, Holm?
I come from down in Johnson County.
What did they run you off for down that way?
They never run me off.
Well, what are you doing up here?
I was hunting work
in John's daddy's old house.
No, sir, I just wanted to lay over there.
Did you have a sign out up there for hiring hands, John?
John smiled cynically, the gun cradled in the crook of his arm.
Not to my recollection,
he said.
No,
the squire said. He leaned back in his chair and drummed his fingers four times on the table edge and looked up at Holm.
Well, Holm, how do you plead?
Plead?
Guilty or not guilty?
I ain't guilty.
You wasn't in John's daddy's old house?
I was in there, but I never broke in.
Well, maybe we can make it just trespass, then.
Holm looked at the man, and the man looked back at him. The squire was tapping his fork idly against the edge of the empty plate and sucking his teeth.
I don't figure I'd done nothing wrong, Holm said.
Well, if you want to plead not guilty, I'll have to take you over to Harmsworth and bind you over in custody until court day.
When is that?
The squire looked up at him.
About 3 weeks,
he said,
if they don't postpone you. If you get postponed, it'll be another 6 weeks after that. And if you get...
I'll take the guilty,
Holm said. The squire leaned forward and pushed away the plate.
Right, he said. Guilty.
He took up a piece of cornbread from a bowl of it in the center of the table and fell to buttering it.
Ethel, he said. Hey, woman.
She came in with a small oak box and set it on the table.
Guilty of trespass, the squire said.
She was fumbling among keys that hung to her by a string. When she got the box open, she took out some forms and a quill and inkstand.
What's his name? She said.
Give her your name,
the squire said.
Culla Holm.
What?
Culla Holm.
How do you spell it?
She was sitting at the end of the table with a quill poised above a document.
I don't know, he said.
He don't know how to spell it, she said.
The squire looked at her and then he looked at Holm. His mouth was full of cornbread.
Put something down, he said. You can guess at it, can't you?
No, sir. I ain't never.
Not you.
Yes, sir.
Say it once more, slow, she said.
He said it. She wrote something.
What was it now?
She said, turning to the squire.
You got his name?
Yes. What was it now?
Housebreak. No, what was it?
Trespass?
Trespass.
He kicked a chair.
Here, John, sit down. You making the place look untidy.
John sat. There was no sound in the room save the scratch of the pen. Holm stood before them, shifting from one foot to the other.
All right, she said.
You ain't forgot the date, have you? Like you done on some of them lastins?
No, she said.
All right.
She turned the paper around and made a little X at the bottom and held the quill toward Holm. He took it and bent above the paper and made an X beside the X and handed back the quill. She signed it and wafted it in the air for a moment and handed it to the squire. He waved it away with a languorous hand and looked at Holm.
I fine you $5, he said.
I ain't got no $5.
The squire blew his nose into a stained rag and put the rag back in his hip pocket.
10 days in,
he said.
You can work it out.
All right.
Sit down.
He turned to the woman.
Put that up now and get him some breakfast.
You had breakfast?
No. Get him some breakfast. Can't work prisoners on an empty stomach. All right, John, was that all it was you wanted?
John was sitting forward in his chair, waving one hand about.
Just a danged minute,
he said.
What is it?
Well, dang it! How many of them 10 days does he work on my place?
The squire had paused with his hand outstretched, scratching at something in his armpit.
Your place?
He said.
My place?
Why would he be coming down to work on your place?
Well, dang it, I brought him in. He was breaking in my daddy's house.
I can't be coming down to your place with him every day just because he happened to pick your daddy's old house to break into. Well, if I hadn't have arrested him, he'd not be here at all.
I appreciate you bringing him in and all, John, but they ain't no reward out for him nor nothing, is they now? I don't make the law, I just carry it out. Well, I don't see why you aren't to benefit from what I done or from what he ain't able to pay. I guess you going to pay back the county his wages or fine or whatever.
The squire had stopped scratching.
Well, now, John, he said, you know my books is open to anybody. Ain't that right, woman?
That's right, the woman said. Holm was watching her. She wasn't listening to any of it.
It wouldn't hurt you none to let me have him a few days out of them 10.
The squire shook his head wearily.
John, he said, you and me has always been good neighbors, ain't we?
I reckon,
John said.
Have I ever turned you down for a favor?
I ain't never asked you none.
Well, you always knowed all you had to do was ask. Ain't that right?
That's right,
the woman said. The squire threw her a sharp look.
I don't know, John said. Ain't this a favor?
No.
No, it's just what's fair.
Don't make no difference about fair or not fair. It's against the law. You ain't authorized to work no prisoners.
I ought to have just shot him and let it go.
No, you done right bringing him in like you done. But you can't ask me to break the law and turn him back over to you. Can you now?
Shit!
Excuse me, ma'am. I wouldn't ask you to break the law, would I now? John?
John had risen from the chair. He didn't look back. He went out through the house with a shotgun hanging in one hand and his boots exploding over the bare boards through the rooms, and they could hear the door latch and then the loud and final closing of the door, and silence again for a moment, and then a riotous squabble of chickens, and then nothing.
"Sit down," the squire said. "What are you doing with your boots off of such a cold morning?"
Holm took the chair the other man had vacated and sat and pulled on the boots laboriously. He stamped his numb feet on the floor, but he could feel nothing. He looked up.
"He told me to just tote 'em. I reckon he figured a feller barefoot be less likely to cut and run."
The squire shook his head sadly.
"I believe he slipped a cog somewheres," he said.
"I never bothered nothing in his old house," Holm said.
"Don't make no difference,"
the squire said.
"You done been sentenced. I give you pretty light for a stranger anyways."
Holm nodded.
"We'll get you started here directly you get your breakfast."
"Thank you," Holm said.
"Don't thank me. I'm just a public servant."
"Yes, sir," he said. Grease was frying violently in a skillet behind him, and the woman was putting biscuits to warm in the oven. His stomach felt like it was chewing.
"The old lady'll fix you a bed here in the kitchen. You ain't no desperate outlaw, are you? Ain't murdered nobody?"
"No, sir. I don't reckon."
"Don't reckon, eh?"
The squire smiled. Holm wasn't smiling. He was looking at the floor.
"Get you fattened up a little here on the old woman's cooking. You'll be all right,"
the squire said.
"Might get some work out of you then, you reckon?"
"Yes, sir. I ain't scared to work."
The squire had tilted back in his chair, regarding him.
"I don't believe you're no bad feller, Holm," he said. "I don't believe you're no lucky feller, neither. My daddy always claimed a man made his own luck. But that's disputable, I reckon."
"I believe my daddy would have disputed it. He always claimed he was the unluckiest man he knowed of."
"That right. Where is he at now? Holm, I reckon, where you..."
"He's dead."
The squire had propped one foot on the chair before him and was rubbing his paunch abstractedly, watching nothing. His hand stopped and he looked at Holm and looked away again.
"Well," he said, "I guess that's about as unlucky as a feller would be likely to get."
"Yes, sir."
"You got airy family at all?"
"I ain't got sign one of kin on this earth," Holm said.
"Here," the woman said. Holm looked vacantly at the steaming plate of eggs before him.
"Holler when you get done eatin',"
the squire said, rising.
"I'll be out in the back."
"All right," Holm said. "How long can I stay?"
The squire stopped at the door.
"What?"
he said. "I said, how long can I stay?"
The squire shrugged his coat over his shoulders.
"It's 10 days at 50 cents a day. That's all."
"What about after that?"
"What about it?"
"I mean, can I stay on longer?"
"What for?"
Well, just to stay. To work.
At 50 cents a day?
I don't care.
Don't care.
I'll stay on just for board if you can use me.
It was very quiet in the kitchen. The squire was standing with one hand on the door. The woman had stopped her puttering with dishes and pots. They were watching him.
I don't believe I can use you, Holm, the squire said. Holler when you get done.
She came from the house onto the porch and stood there taking the soft evening air and smelling the rich ground beyond the road where he followed the mule down the creek and back and down again through a deepening haze, he and the mule alike beset by plovers who pass and wheel and repass and at length give up the long blue dusk to bats. The flowers in the dooryard have curled and drawn as if poisoned by dark, and there is a mockingbird to tell what he knows of night. She sat quietly in the rocker. It was full dark when he came up from the bottoms, stooped under the small Japanese plow, the mule coming behind him in the gloom, and the two passing like shades, but for the paced, hollow clop of the mule's shoeless feet in the road, and then the softer sound in the wet grass, and the slight chink of harness until they went beyond hearing into the barn lot. She was not even rocking. After a while, she heard him in the house, and he lit a lamp and came to the porch door and called her. She rose and went in. Passed him wordlessly, and her slippers like mice along the dark hallway until he caught up behind her and led her way into the kitchen where she began to fix his supper. He sat at the table watching her, his hands cupped uselessly in his lap and his face red in the lamplight, watching her move from the stove to the safe and back, mute, shuffling, wooden. When she set the greens and cold pork and milk before him, he looked at them dumbly for a long time before he took up his fork. And he ate listlessly like a man in sorrow. She started past him toward the door, and he took her by the elbow.
"Hold up a minute," he said.
She stopped and came about slowly, doll-like, one arm poised. She was not looking at him.
"Look here at me. Rinthy."
She swung her eyes vaguely toward him.
"You ain't even civil," he said. "It ain't civil to come and go that away and not say nothing, never."
"I ain't got nothing to say."
"Well, damn it, you could say something. Hello, or goodbye, or kiss my ass. Something, couldn't you?"
"I've not took up cussing yet," she said.
"Just hello or goodbye, then. Couldn't you?"
"I reckon."
"Well?"
"Good night," she said. He watched her go, his jaw let down to speak again, but not speaking, watched her fade from the reach of the powdery lamplight, and heard her steps soft on the moaning stairboards and the wooden clap of the door closing.
"Good night," he said.
He drank the last of the milk from the glass and wiped his mouth on his shoulder in a curious bird-like gesture. He'd see all night again tonight the mule's hasped hoofs wristing up before him, and the cool earth passing and passing, canting dark and moldy with humus across the coulter, with that dull and watery sound, interspersed with the click of bedded creek stones. A moth had got in and floundered at the lamp chimney with great eyed wings, lay prostrate and quivering on the greasy oilcloth table cover. He crushed it with his fist and flicked it from sight and sat before the empty plate, drumming his fingers in the moth-shaped swatch of glinting dust it left. She did not know that she was leaving. She woke in the night and rose, half-tranced, from the bed and began to dress, all in darkness and with gravity. Perhaps some dream had moved her so. She took her few things from the chiffer robe and bundled them and went to the landing beyond her door. She listened for his breathing in the room opposite, but she could hear nothing. She crouched in the dark long and long for fear he was awake, and when she did descend the stairs in her bare feet, she paused again at the bottom in the dead black foyer and listened up the stairwell. And she waited again at the front door with it open, poised between the maw of the dead and loveless house and the outer dark like a frail thief. It was damp and cool, and she could hear roosters beginning. She closed the door and went down the path to the gate and into the road, shivering in the cold starlight, under Vega and the water serpent. She went west on the road while the sky grew pale and the waking world of shapes accrued about her. Hurrying along with the sunrise at her back, she had the look of some deranged refugee from its occurrence. Before she had gone far, she heard a horse on the road behind her, and she fled into the wood with her heart at her throat. It came out of the sun at a slow canter, in a silhouette agonized to shapelessness. She crouched in the bushes and watched it, a huge horse emerging seared and whole from the sun's eye, and passing like a wrecked caravel, gaunt-ribbed and black, and mad, with tattered saddle and dangling stirrups, and hoofs clopping softly in the dust, and passing enormous and emaciate and inflamed, and the sound of it dying down the road to a distant echo of applause in a hall forever empty. On a good spring day, he paused to rest at the side of the road. He had been walking for a long time, and he had been hearing them for a long time before he knew what the sound was, a faint, murmurous droning portending multitudes, locusts, the advent of primitive armies. He rose and went on until he reached the gap in the ridge, and before long he could see the first of them coming along the road below him. And then suddenly the entire valley was filled with hogs, a weltering sea of them that came smoking over the dusty plain and flowed undiminished into the narrows of the cut, fanning on the slopes and ragged shoals like the harried outer guard of schooled fish, and here and there upright and cursing among them and laboring with poles, the drovers, gaunt and fever-eyed with incredible rag costumes and wild hair. Holm left the road and clambered up the rocky slope to give them leeway. The first of the drovers was beating his way obliquely across the herd toward him, the hogs flaring and squealing and closing behind him again like syrup. When he gained the open ground, he came along easily, smiling up to where Holm sat on a rock, with his feet dangling, and looking down with no little wonder at this spectacle.
"Howdy, neighbor," called out the drover. "Sweet day, ain't she?"
"It is," he said. "Whereabouts are you headed with them hogs, if you don't care for me asking?"
"Cross the mountain to Charlestown."
Holm shook his head reverently.
"That there is the damnedest sight of hogs ever I seen," he said. "How many you got?"
The drover had come about the base of the rock and was now standing looking down with Holm at the passing hogs.
"God hisself don't know," he said solemnly. "Well, it's a bunch."
"They, Lord," said the drover. "They just now commencing to come inside."
He passed his stave from the crook of one arm to the other and cocked one foot on the ledge of rock, his sparse whiskers fluttering in the mountain wind, leaning forward and watching the howling polychrome tide of hogs that glutted the valley from wall to wall, as might any chance traveler a thing of interest.
"They's more than one mule foot in that lot," he said.
"What?
Mule foot? I calculate they's several hundred head of them alone, and they ain't no common hog to come upon."
"What's a mule foot?" Holm said.
The drover squinted professionally.
"Mountain hog from north of here? You ain't never seen one?"
"No.
Got a foot like a mule."
"You mean they ain't got a split hoof?"
"Nary split to it."
"I ain't never seen no such hog as that," Holm said.
"I ain't surprised," the drover said. "But you can see one here if you've a mind to."
"I'd admire to," Holm said.
The drover shifted his stave again.
"Seems like that don't agree with the Bible. What would you say?"
"About what?"
"About them hogs being unclean on account of they got a split foot."
"I ain't never heard that," Holm said.
"I heard it preached in a sermon one time. Feller knowed right smart about the subject. Said the devil had a foot like a hog's. He laid claim it was in the Bible, so I reckon it's so."
"I reckon."
"He said a Jew wouldn't eat hog meat on account of it."
"What's a Jew?"
"That's one of them old-timey people from in the Bible. But that still don't say nothing about a mule-foot hog, does it? What about him?"
"I don't know," Holmes said. "What about him?"
"Well, is he a hog or ain't he, according to the Bible?"
"I'd say a hog was a hog if he didn't have nary feet at all."
"I might do it myself," the drover said, "because if he was to have feet, you'd look for him to be hog's feet. Like, if you had a hog didn't have no head, you'd know it for a hog, anyways. But if you seen one walking around with a mule's head on him, you might be puzzled."
"That's true," Holm allowed.
"Yes, sir. Makes you wonder some about the Bible and about hogs, too, don't it?"
"Yes," Holm said.
"I've studied it a good deal, and I can't come to no conclusions about it one way or the other."
"No."
The drover stroked his whiskers and nodded his head.
"Hogs is a mystery by theyselves," he said. "What can a feller know about one? Not a whole lot, I've run with hogs since I was just a shirt tail, and I ain't never come to no real understanding of 'em. And I don't doubt but what other folks has had the same experience. A hog is a hog, pure and simple, and that's about all you can say about him. And smart? Don't think they ain't. Smart as the devil. And don't be fooled by one that ain't got nary clove foot, 'cause he's devilish, too. I guess hogs is hogs, Holmes said. The drover spat and nodded. That's what I've always maintained, he said. Holmes was watching the activity below them. That's my little brother Billy yander, the drover said, pointing with one tatter-clad arm. This is his first time along. I thought Mama was going to bawl sure enough when we lit out and him with us. Says he going to get him some poontang when we get sold, but I told him he'd be long done partial to she-hogs. The drover turned and bared his orange-colored teeth at home in a grimace of lecherous idiocy. Home turned and watched the hogs. The drover stood among them like crossers in a ford, emerging periodically out of the shifting pall of red dust and then blotted away again. They seemed together with the hogs to be in flight from some act of God, fire or flood, schisms in the earth's crust. I better get on and give them fellers a hand, the drover said. Luck to you, Holmes said. We'll be stopped up on the river somewheres come dark. If you chance by that way, just stop and take supper with us. Thank you, said Holmes. I'd be proud to. The drover waved his staff and scrabbled away over the rocks like a thin gnome. Holmes sat for a while and then rose and followed along the ridge toward the gap where the hogs were crossing. The gap was narrow, and when he got to it, he could see the hogs welled up in a clamorous and screeching flume that fanned again on the far side in a high meadow skirting the bluff of the river. They were wheeling faster and wider out along the sheer rim of the bluff in an arc of dusty uproar, and he could hear the drovers below him calling, and he could see the dead gray serpentine of the river below that. Hogs were pouring through the gap and building against the ones in the meadow until these began to buckle at the edges. Holmes saw two of them pitch, screaming in stiff-legged pirouettes 100 feet into the river. He moved down the slope toward the bluff and the road that went along it. Drovers were racing brokenly across the milling hogs with staves aloft, stumbling and falling among them, making for the outer perimeter to head them from the cliff. This swept a new wave of panic among the hogs like wind through grass until a whole echelon of them careering up the outer flank forsook the land and fared into space with torn cries. Now the entire herd had begun to wheel wider and faster along the bluff, and the outermost ranks swung centrifugally over the escarpment, row on row, wailing and squealing, and above this the howls and curses of the drovers that now upreared in the moil of flesh they tended and swept with dust had begun to assume satanic looks with their staves and wild eyes, as if they were no true swineherds, but disciples of darkness got among these charges to herd them to their doom. Holmes rushed to higher ground like one threatened with flood, and perched upon a rock there to view the course of things. The hogs were in full stampede. One of the drovers passed curiously erect, as though braced with a stick, and rotating slowly with his arms outstretched in the manner of a dancing sleeper. Hogs were beginning to wash up on the rock, their hoofs clicking and rasping, and with harsh snorts. Holmes recoiled to the rock's crown and watched them. The drover who had spoken him swept past with bowed back and hands aloft, a limp and ragged scarecrow flailing briefly in that rabid frieze, so that Holmes saw tilted upon him for just a moment out of the dust and pandemonium, two walled eyes beyond hope and a dead mouth beyond prayer, borne on like some old gospel recreant seized sevenfold in the flood of his own nether invocations, or grotesque hero bobbing harried and unwilling on the shoulders of a mob, stricken in their iniquity to the very shape of evil, until he passed over the rim of the bluff and dropped in his great retinue of hogs from sight. Holmes blinked and shook his head. The hogs boiled past, squealing and plunging, and the chalky red smoke of their passage hung over the river and stained the sky with something of sunset. They had begun to veer from the bluff and to swing in a long arc upriver. The drovers all had sought shelter among the trees, and Holmes could see a pair of them watching the herd pass with looks of indolent speculation, leaning upon their staves and nodding in mute agreement, as if there were some old injustice being righted in this spectacle of headlong bedlam. When the last of the hogs had gone in a rapidly trebling thunder and the ochreous dust had drifted from the torn ground, and there was nothing but quaking silence about him, Holmes climbed gingerly from his rock. Some drovers were coming from the trees, and three pink shoats labored up over the rim of the hill with whimpering sounds not unlike kittens, and bobbed past and upriver over the gently smoking land like creatures in a dream. Holmes walked slowly up the bluff,
The sun was bright, and it was a fine spring day. The drovers had begun to assemble, and they seemed in no hurry to overtake the hogs. They were handing about plugs and pouches of tobacco with an indifferent conviviality. "That beats everything I ever seen," one said.
"That's pitiful about your brother."
"I don't know what all I'm going to tell Mama. Herded off a bluff with a parcel of hogs. I don't know how I'm going to tell her that."
"You could tell her he was drunk.
Tell her he got shot or something.
You wouldn't need to tell her he went to his reward with a herd of hogs."
He shook his head sorrowfully.
"Lord, I just don't know," he said.
"I just wished I knowed what to tell her."
"You won't see her for a couple of months anyways, Billy. Give you time to think some about it."
"What happened?"
Holmes said. One of the drovers looked at him.
"They, Lord," he said, "where was you at? Did you not see them hogs?"
"I seen him a-settin' on a rock over yander," Billy said. "Vernon went right past him, and he never reached to help him nor nothing." The drovers looked at him, a bizarre collection of faces that seemed assembled from scraps and oddments, all hairy-faced and filthy and half-toothless, and their weathered chops lumpy with tobacco chews. One spat and squinted up at Holm.
"That right, stranger?"
he said. Holm ignored him.
"I didn't see you coming to help," he said.
"I wasn't near him," Billy said. "I couldn't have got to him. You was right there."
"I seen him a-settin' on that rock."
"That's all right about him settin' on some rock. Who was it got them hogs started in the first place?"
"That's right. How come him to do that-a-way?"
"Where was you at, stranger, when them hogs commenced running crazy?"
"I wasn't nowheres. I was way back yander."
"Behind him, kindly.
He just watched Vernon go right on out over the bluff and never said diddly shit."
"Something had to have spooked them hogs that away."
"Well, ain't he just said he'd come up behind him?"
"He never raised a hand one to save him."
"Stranger, we don't take too kind to people running off folks' stock.
We ain't got a whole lot of use for troublemakers hereabouts."
"Vernon never bothered nobody. You can ask anybody."
"Shit," Holmes said. "You sons of bitches are crazy." "Peace be on all you fellers,"
a voice sang up behind them. Two of the drovers removed their hats. Holmes looked around to see what was occurring. A parson, or what looked like one, was laboring over the crest of the hill and coming toward them with one hand raised in blessing, greeting, fending flies. He was dressed in a dusty frock coat and carried a walking stick, and he wore a pair of octagonal glasses, on the one pane of which the late sun shone, while a watery eye peered from the naked wire aperture of the other.
"What's the ruckus here, eh?"
He drew up and looked from one to the other among them, and looked at the ground as if he had forgotten something, taking a kerchief from his sleeve and snorting into it.
"Howdy, Reverend,"
said Billy.
"Howdy. Bless all of yous. They, Lord, what's been through here?"
"Hogs," said one of the drovers.
"Damnedest mess of hogs you ever seen. Excuse me."
"Hard words don't bother me no more than does hard ways," said the Reverend.
"That's what all I'm here for."
"What's he done? You ain't fixing to hang him, are you?"
"Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Don't hold with hanging at all, lessen it's legal."
"What possessed them hogs, anyways?"
"This here feller run 'em off," Billy said.
"I never done it," Holmes said.
"The hell you never!"
"Here now, somebody's lying. You, young feller, look me in the eye and tell me you never run them hogs off."
"I never run 'em off," Holmes said. The drovers pressed about to watch. The preacher looked at the ground again, stuffing the kerchief back up his sleeve.
"Well, Reverend?"
"I believe he run 'em off."
"I told you," Billy said.
"God damn it," Holmes said. "I wasn't nowhere."
"Watch that talk in front of the preacher, boy," one of the drovers said.
"But don't hang him, boys," the Reverend said. "Don't do it. We'll take him into justice.
Render unto Caesar what all's his'n. He shoved Brother Billy's brother Vernon off the bluff with the hogs."
"Just a goddamn minute," Holmes said.
"There he goes again with that mouth."
"Don't hang him, boys," the preacher cried out. "No good'll ever come of it. Everybody's seen what he done.
Billy said. You all seen it? The preacher looked like a charred bird. He was peering at the ground and pounding his cane there.
Ah, don't hang him, he said. Oh, Lord, don't hang him,
shaking his head and muttering these things loudly over and over.
I wished you'd hush about some hanging,
Holmes said.
It's a serious thing, the preacher said. I don't advocate it save under the strongest extremes. Well, if you'd hush about it. Tore up with guilt.
The preacher nodded, sad and negative.
Plum tore up with it.
We all seen him on that rock.
How come you to do it, son?
Holmes looked about him for some sign of sanity.
Shit,
he said.
I believe we done mentioned it to you once about that barnyard talk.
The preacher had begun to gesture inanely with his cane.
Boys, I believe he's plumb eat up with the devil in him. But don't hang him.
Or to throw him off the bluff the way he done Vernon,
Billy said.
How far down is it?
The preacher was interested.
Too far to walk back.
Billy don't know what all to tell his ma, Reverend. He just don't have no notion how to go about telling her. Ain't that right, Billy?
I don't know what none of us is going to tell Green come upon his hogs. They must have been 200 head fell off in the river.
Don't flang him off the bluff, boys, the preacher said. I believe ye'd be better to hang him as that.
I believe we would, too.
What do you say, Billy? He's your brother.
I believe I dressed easier. I believe Vernon would have wanted it that away. Lesson, he's got some choice.
They looked at home.
Vernon never had none, Billy said.
He's right about that.
Well, he probably don't care no way. You got any particular stranger, strung up or flying off in the river?
Holmes wiped his palms down the sides of his overall legs and looked about him with wide eyes.
Let's hang him if he don't care. I ain't never seen nobody hung.
We ain't got nary rope.
They stopped and looked from one to the other.
Rope? Can't hang him without a rope.
There's one in the wagon. Cecil's got one in the wagon.
They lord, he'll be 10 mile up the river before we catch him.
He'll be stopped making camp now, late as it is. We hurry, we can get up there and get him hung afore dark.
Let's just throw him off the bluff and be done with it.
No, that ain't no way to do. Besides, Billy wants him hung.
I believe Vernon would have wanted it that away, Billy said.
I believe old Green will be comforted some, too.
Don't flang him off the bluff, boys. Tain't Christian.
Let's go, then. Pump up there, stranger, and let's go get hung.
They started up the river. The preacher fell in alongside Holmes.
What place of devilment you hail from, mister?
He asked. Holmes looked at him wearily. I don't come from no place of devilment, he said. I come from Johnson County.
Never heard tell of it. You a Christian?
Yes.
I can't say as you've much took on the look of one.
That ain't marked you a whole lot to notice, neither,
Holmes said.
Don't disparage the cloth, son,
the preacher said.
Don't disparage the cloth.
Cloth ass,
Holmes said.
Well now, said the preacher, what have we here? I believe it's a hard enough case to give Jehovah hisself the witherings.
Holmes didn't answer.
Might be something of a comfort to have a preacher there at your final hour,
the preacher went on, if your heart ain't just scabbed over with sin.
You don't look like much of a preacher to me,
Holmes said.
I'll bet I don't,
the preacher said.
I'd just bet I don't at that, to you.
Holmes trudged along over the chopped ground. They were following the swath the hogs had made.
Where was it you was a-going, anyways?
The preacher asked.
Just down to the next town. Guess you never reckoned when you set out this morning that you was on your way to be hung, did you?
Holmes ignored him.
A feller never knows what day'll be his last in this vale of tears. You been baptized?
Why don't you go on and walk somewheres else? Holmes said.
I guess a feller mires up so deep in sin, after a while he don't want to hear nothing about grace and salvation. Not even a feller about to be hung dead.
It ain't no use, Reverend,
He's too mean to be saved.
Most probably you're right, the Reverend said, but I sure would love to do it if I could. It'd make a Jim Dandy sermon. I saved a blind feller once, wanted to curse God for his affliction. You all want to hear that? It's a strong sermon. I like to save it for best.
Tell it, Reverend.
I won't tell it all. This blind feller hollered out one time and said, "Looky here at me, blind and all. I guess you reckon I ought to love Jesus." "Well, neighbor," I says, "I believe you ought. He give you eyes to see, and then he tuck 'em away. And maybe you never was much of a Christian to start with, and he figured this'd bring you round. They's been more than one feller brought to the love of Jesus over the paths of affliction, and what better way than blind? In a world darksome as this, and I believe a blind man ought to be better sighted than most. I believe it's got a good deal to recommend it. The grace of God don't rest easy on a man. It can blind him easy as not. It can bend him and make him crooked. And who did Jesus love, friends? The lame, the halt, and the blind, that's who. Them is the ones scarred with God's mercy, stricken with his love. Ever legless fool and old blind mess like you is a flower in the garden of God. Amen. I told him that.
That's a right pretty sermon, Reverend. I wished Vernon could have heard it.
He knelt right there and was saved on the spot, the Reverend said.
The path had come down from the high bluffs and was going along the river, and already it was late afternoon. Holm looked about, stepped past the preacher and the drover next to him, and jumped. It was a long way down, and when he hit, he felt something tear in his leg. He came up with a mouthful of muddy water and spat and turned. They were aligned along the bluff, watching him. The preacher had both hands aloft, gesturing. The drovers against the pale sky were small, erect, simian shapes. The seven of them watched him. He could hear the preacher's voice. The current was carrying him on, and his leg was hurting, but he kept watching them. And after a while, they were very small, and then they turned and went on along the bluff with no order, rank, or valence to anything in the shapen world. What discordant vespers do the tinker's goods chime through the long twilight and over the brindled forest road? Him stooped and hounded through the windy recrements of day, like those old exiles who, divorced of corporeality and enjoined ingress of heaven or hell, wander forever the middle warrens, spoorless, increate, and anathema. Hounded by grief, by guilt, or, like this cheerless vendor, clamored at heel through wood and fen by his own querulous and inconsolable wares in perennial tin malediction. In the clearing, he set down his cart and circled the remains of a fire, out of which rose a slender stem of smoke, like the pistil of a burnt flower, his thin nose constricted and eyes wary. Shapes of risen sleepers lay in the pressed and poisoned grass. He set out the child and gathered wood and built back the fire. Dark fell, and bats came to hunt the glade, crossing above the figure sulking there on his gaunt shanks like little voiceless souls. Then they went away. A fox stopped barking. The tinker in his moth-gnawn blanket nodded. The child slept. The three men, when they came, might have risen from the ground. The tinker could not account for them. They gathered about the fire and looked down at him. One had a rifle and was smiling. "Howdy," the tinker said. Holm came limping out of the woods and crossed a small field toward the light, insects rising out of the dark and breaking on his face like rain, and his fingers trailing in the tops of the wet sedge. He could hear no sound save a faint moaning like the wind, but there was no wind. When he entered the glade, he could see men seated about the fire, and he hobbled on, one hand raised into the firelight. When he saw what figures warmed there, he was already among them, and it was too late. There were three of them, and there was a child squatting in the dust, and beyond them the tinker's cart with the hung pans catching the light, like the baleful eyes of some outsized and mute and mindless jury assembled there hurriedly against his coming.
"Howdy," said the bearded one. "Ain't seen you for a while."
He looked at them.
They wore the same clothes, sat in the same attitudes, endowed with a dream's redundancy. Like revenants that reoccur in lands laid waste with fever. Spectral. Palpable as stone. He looked at the child. It had a healed burn all down one side of it, and the skin was papery and wrinkled like an old man's. It was naked and half-coated with dust, so that it seemed lightly furred, and when it turned to look up at him, he saw one eyeless and angry red socket, like a stokehole to a brain in flames. He looked away. "Set and rest a spell," the man said. Holmes squatted, favoring his off leg. The child kept watching him. "Who's younger'n?" he said. Harmon guffawed and slapped his thigh. "What happened to his eye?" Holmes said. "What eye?" "His eye," he gestured. "The one he ain't got." "I reckon he must have lost it somewheres. He still got one." "He ought to have two." "Maybe he ought to have more than that. Some folks has two and can't see." Holmes didn't say anything. "I reckon that tinker might know what happened to it." "What tinker?" "That in yan tree," said Harmon, pointing with the rifle. "Hush. Don't pay him no mind, mister. What did you do to your leg there?" "Nothing." The bearded one was tunneling gouts of mud from the welt of his boot with a stick. "Well, I see you didn't have no trouble finding us." "I wasn't hunting you." "You got here all right for somebody bound elsewhere." "I wasn't bound nowheres. I just seen the fire." "I like to keep a good fire. A man never knows what all might chance along. Does he?"
"No."
"No. Anything's liable to wash up. From nowheres, nowhere bound." "Where are you bound?" Holmes said.
"I ain't,"
the man said.
"By nothing."
He looked up at home.
"We ain't hard to find, once you've found us."
Home looked away. His sweat-blistered forehead shone in the firelight. He looked toward the tinker's cart, and he looked at the child.
"Where's she at?"
he said.
"Who's that?"
"My sister."
"Ah," said the man, "the one run off of that tinker."
"Them's his traps, yander." The bearded one turned his head slightly and looked and turned back.
"Aye,"
he said, "that and you used to trade with." "I never give him no chap," Holmes said. "I just told her that."
"Maybe this and some other chap."
"It ain't nothing to me." The bearded one raked a goblet of clay from his stick and cast it into the fire.
"You know what I figure?"
he said.
"What?" "I figure you got this thing here in her belly your own self and then laid it off on that tinker."
"I never laid nothing off on no tinker."
"I reckon you figured he'd keep him hid for you."
"I never figured nothing."
"What did you have to give him?"
"I never give nobody nothing. I never had nothing."
"Never figured nothing, never had nothing, never was nothing,"
the man said. He was looking at nothing at all. The mute one seemed to sleep, crouched at the man's right with his arms dangling between his knees, like something waiting to be wakened and fed.
"What are you?"
Holmes muttered.
"What?"
He said it again sullenly. The bearded one smiled.
"Ah," he said. "Now, we've heard that before, ain't we?"
"You ain't nothing to me." But the man didn't seem to hear. He nodded as if spoken by other voices. He didn't look at home.
"You never did say what you done with your sister."
"I never done nothing with her."
"Where's she at?"
"I don't know. She run off."
"You done told that."
"It ain't nothing to you.
I'll be the judge of that."
Harmon turned, his cheek against the upright rifle barrel. He smiled dreamily.
"I reckon little sister's just a little further on up the road, ain't she?"
the man said. "I don't know. I ain't seen her."
"No. I allowed maybe you had,"
Holmes said.
"You seem to know everybody's business." "I guess it ain't nothing to me. Is that right?"
Holmes didn't answer. The man wiped the stick and poked it into the fire and stretched forth his boot. "Hand him here," he said.
"What?"
"Hand him here, Yan Chap." Holm didn't move. The child had not stopped watching him.
"Unless you'd rather for Harmon to."
He looked at Harmon and then he bent forward and picked up the child. It made no gesture at all. It dangled from his hands like a dressed rabbit, a gross eldritch doll with ricket-sprung legs and one eye opening and closing softly like a naked owl's. He rose with it and circled the fire and held it out toward the man. The man looked at it a moment, and then took it with one hand by its upper arm and placed it between his feet.
"What do you want with him?"
Holmes said.
"Nothing. No more than you do."
"He ain't nothing to me."
"No. Where's that tinker at if he was raising him?" "He's all raised out. He can't raise no more."
"You don't need him."
"Water in the summer and fire in the winter is all the need I need. We ain't talking about what I need."
He spat across the child's head into the fire, and a thin chain of sparks ascended in the gray-green smoke.
"That ain't what's concerned."
"No."
"You ain't no different from the rest, from any man born and raised and have his own and die. They ain't one man in three got even a black suit to die in."
Holmes stood with his feet together and his hands at his sides like one arraigned.
"What's his name?"
The man said.
"I don't know." "He ain't got Narian."
"No, I don't reckon. I don't know."
"They say people in hell ain't got names, but they had to be called something to get sent there, didn't they?"
"That tinker might have named him."
"It wasn't his to name. Besides, names dies with the namers. A dead man's dog ain't got a name."
He reached and drew from his boot a slender knife. Holmes seemed to be speaking to something in the night beyond them all.
"My sister would take him," he said.
"That chap. We could find her and she'd take him."
"Yes," the man said. "I've been hunting her."
Harmon was watching the man. Even the mute one stirred. The man took hold of the child and lifted it up. It was watching the fire. Holmes saw the blade wink in the light like a long cat's eye, slant and malevolent, and a dark smile erupted on the child's throat and went all broken down the front of it. The child made no sound. It hung there with its one eye glazing over like a wet stone and the black blood pumping down its naked belly. The mute one knelt forward. He was drooling and making little whimpering noises in his throat. He knelt with his hands outstretched and his nostrils wrinkled delicately. The man handed him the child and he seized it up, looked once at home with witless eyes, and buried his moaning face in its throat. Late in the afternoon, she entered the glade, coming down a footpath where narrow cart tracks had crushed the weeds, and through the wood, half wild and haggard in her shapeless, sun-drained cerements, yet delicate as any fallow doe, and so into the clearing to stand cradled in a grail of jade and windy light, slender and trembling and pale, with wand-like hands to speak the boneless shapes attending her. And stepping softly with her air of blooded ruin about the glade in a frail agony of grace, she trailed her rags through dust and ashes, circling the dead fire, the charred billets and chalk bones, the little calcined ribcage. She poked among the burnt remains of the tinker's traps, the blackened pans confused among the rubble, the lantern with its skewed glass, the axle and iron wheel hoops already rusting. She went among this charnel curiously. She did not know what to make of it. She waited, but no one returned. She waited all through the blue twilight and into the dark. Bats came and went. Wind stirred the ashes and the tinker in his tree turned slowly. But no one returned. Shadows grew cold across the wood, and night rang down upon these lonely figures, and after a while, little sister was sleeping. The tinker in his burial tree was a wonder to the birds, the vultures that came by day to nose with their hooked beaks among his buttons and pockets, like outrageous pets, soon left him naked of his rags and flesh alike. Black mandrake sprang beneath the tree as at will where the seed of the hanged falls, and in spring a new branch pierced his breast and flowered in a green boutonniere, perennial beneath his yellow grin. He took the sparse winter snows upon what thatch of hair still clung to his dried skull, and hunters that passed that way never chanced to see him brooding among his barren limbs. Until wind had told the tinker's bones, and seasons loosed them one by one to the ground below, and alone his bleached and weathered brisket hung in that lonesome wood like a bone birdcage. In later years he used to meet a blind man, ragged and serene, who spoke him a good day out of his constant dark. He overtook him tapping through the bright noon dust with his cane, his head erect in that air of wonder the blind wear. Home would go by, but now the blind man has stopped him with his greeting.
"How are you?" said Home.
"Well as ever," said the blind man. "Have you a smoke?"
"No, sir, I ain't."
"Nary at all?"
"I don't have the habit."
"Aye," said the blind man.
He unbuttoned the bib of his overalls and brought forth tobacco.
"Well," he said, "it's good to see the sun again, ain't it?"
Home looked at the cups of blue phlegm which regarded him.
"It is,"
he said.
"Aye, after so long a time."
He trickled tobacco into the slender trough of paper his fingers held and put away the pouch.
"It is a right pretty day," Home said.
The blind man smiled.
"I know ye," he said. "I've spoke afore with ye."
"You might have," Home said. "I don't remember." The blind man twisted up the ends of his cigarette and took it between his lips.
"Yes," he said, "I've passed you on these roads afore."
"There's lots of people on the roads these days," Holmes said.
"Yes," the blind man said, "I pass them every day. People going up and down in the world like dogs, as if they wasn't a home nowheres. But I knowed I'd seen you afore."
Holmes spat.
"I got to get on," he said.
"Yes," the blind man said. "Is there anything you need?"
"Need?"
"Anything you need?"
"I don't need nothing. I always like to ask."
"What are you selling?"
"I ain't selling nothing. I'm at the Lord's work. He don't need your money."
"It's good he don't need mine. I reckon you're some kind of a preacher."
"No, no preacher. What is they to preach? It's all plain enough. Word and flesh, I don't hold much with preaching."
Holmes smiled.
"What have you got to give? Old blind man like you asking folks what they need?"
"I don't know. Nobody's never said."
"Well, how would you expect to get it?"
"Just pray for it." "You always get what you pray for?"
"Yes, I reckon. I wouldn't pray for what wasn't needful, would you?"
"I ain't never prayed."
"Why don't you pray back your eyes?"
"I believe it'd be a sin.
Them old eyes can only show you what's done there anyways. If a blind man needed eyes, he'd have eyes."
"Still, I believe you'd like to see your way."
"What needs a man to see his way when he's sent there anyhow?"
"I got to get on," Holmes said. The blind man leaned one hand on the cane where he had rested it against his leg. He sucked on the cigarette, and two jets of blue smoke slid from his thin nostrils and faded in the air.
"I heard a preacher in a town one time," he said. "A healing preacher wanted to cure everybody, and they took me up there. There was a bunch of us there, all crippled folks, and one old man they did claim had throwed down his crutches, and they told it he could make the blind see. And they was a feller leapt up and hollered out that nobody knowed what was wrong with, and they said it caused that preacher to go away. But they's darksome ways afoot in this world, and it may be he weren't no true preacher."
"I got to get on," Holmes said.
"I always did want to find that feller," the blind man said, "and tell him. If somebody don't tell him, he never will have no rest."
"I'll see you," Holmes said.
"Aye," said the blind man. "It might be we'll meet again sometime."
Holmes raised a hand in inane farewell and set off down the road again. The blind man's cane, softly tapping, faded behind him. He went on, soundless with his naked feet, shambling, grace-lorn, down out of the peaceful, mazy fields, his toed tracks soft in the dust among the cratered shapes of horse and mule hoofs, and before him under the high afternoon sun his shadow bewandered in a dark parody of his progress. The road went on through a shadeless burn, and for miles there were only the charred shapes of trees in a dead land where nothing moved save windy rifts of ash that rose dolorous and died again down the blackened corridors. Late in the day, the road brought him into a swamp, and that was all. Before him stretched a spectral waste, out of which reared only the naked trees in attitudes of agony, and dimly hominoid, like figures in a landscape of the damned. A faintly smoking garden of the dead that tended away to the earth's curve. He tried his foot in the mire before him, and it rose in a volvate welt, claggy and sucking. He stepped back. A stale wind blew from this desolation, and the marsh reeds and black ferns among which he stood clashed softly like things chained. He wondered why a road should come to such a place. Going back the way by which he came, he met again the blind man tapping through the dusk. He waited very still by the side of the road, but the blind man passing turned his head and smiled upon him his blind smile. Holm watched him out of sight. He wondered where the blind man was going, and did he know how the road ended? Someone should tell a blind man before setting him out that way. End of Outer Dark by Cormac McCarthy.